was not always collected into book form. And so you have all these different sources giving the resurrection accounts, both resurrection appearances of Christ, and any other literature that would be considered multiple attestations, multiple accounts. But because the New Testament, because the Bible is a double standard is introduced, a higher test, and I know just pretty much unreasonable test for authenticity or reliability for the Bible, and then a different lower bar, a lower standard for everything else. People consider all the whole New Testament just one account, as if it was all written by like one guy or whatever. So. Which isn't their argument anyway, but I mean it just does not hold water. But whatever the case, before you talk about answering the question, did Jesus rise from the dead, you have to answer the question, well, are miracles possible? I mean, if miracles are by definition impossible, okay, then it makes no sense to ask, well, did Jesus really rise from the dead in history? In other words, the philosophical question, are miracles possible, takes priority to the question, did Jesus actually rise from the dead in history? So the philosophical question of miracles comes before the historical question of, is a particular miracle claim true? Okay? Now, I've got down as David Hume's view, but it's a stronger interpretation of David Hume's view. David Hume lived from 1711 to 1776. The stronger interpretation of David Hume's view on miracles is a false interpretation. It's a misinterpretation of David Hume. David Hume really didn't use this argument. The argument that I'm going to spell out is actually Benedict Spinoza's view. Hume, as a fairly consistent empiricist who believed knowledge could only be found through the five senses, would never come up with an argument like this. This is not an empirical type argument that deals with probabilities, because that's all you have in the world of the senses. This instead is a rationalistic argument which is trying to, using deduction, is trying to arrive at a conclusion with logical necessity, and therefore it's a rational argument. And so Spinoza would argue like this, miracles are violations, they're contradictions of the laws of nature. The laws of nature cannot be violated or contradicted, therefore it's impossible for miracles to occur. Okay? Now see, in Benedict Spinoza's thought, okay, he was an extreme rationalist. In his thought, God did not create the universe because he chose to, he freely chose to. Instead, God had to create the universe. The universe just naturally emanated from him. Spinoza's not a pantheist, but he's definitely not a theist. He's somewhere out there, but the closest thing to his views would be pantheism. God didn't choose to create the universe. It just eternally emanates from him. Okay? What's that? You can't call him a pantheist, you can't even call him a panentheist, but he's somewhere, he's one of a kind. It was just, a lot of it was due to the fact that he was a pure rationalist, and he accepted the ontological argument for God's existence, that God must exist by definition.
God had no choice.
But the thing is,
it's part of
with Spinoza, you know, he wants to know everything through certainty, and it's kind of like, since God is the absolute perfect being, he could not make any mistakes, and this has to be the greatest possible world. Spinoza would not say this is the greatest possible way to achieve the greatest possible world, like Geisler, a Christian philosopher, would say, but this is the greatest possible world. And so therefore the laws of nature are the most perfect way of doing things, and that any interruption or contradiction or violation of them automatically it would be God admitting, okay, I made a mistake, I could have done it better. And so he sees no exceptions to these laws of nature. But the laws of nature are...
God's bound by the
laws. Yeah, it's like rather than... Yeah, God is bound by the laws of nature, because the laws of nature hold as much weight as the laws of logic. They have to be that way.
Plato's saying, good is greater than God.
Because
God has to... It's good.
It's different with Spinoza, because God would be the greatest in his thought, but it's more like even Christians would say that God is bound by his infinite nature. Yeah. Spinoza would add more baggage to that nature.
So he doesn't consider the universe or the laws of nature to be part of God's nature, but just something he has no choice in.
It's what necessarily, many Christians, and I believe the Christians that are correct on this, would agree with Augustine that the laws of logic eternally flow from God's nature, and it couldn't be any other way. But Spinoza does that with the laws of nature as well. Keep in mind, where Spinoza comes very close to pantheism, you know, this physical universe isn't ultimately real. You know, as this like extreme rationalist, the ultimately real is the rational, not the physical. You know, it's the empiricist that... it's to the point where sometimes if a rationalist even believes in the existence of the physical world, he has to almost call himself an empirical rationalist or a rational empiricist to distance himself from a Spinoza. But whatever the case, so for Spinoza, you know, the laws of nature, just no violation to them whatsoever. Now, the way you refute that is that, okay, we now know science no longer views the laws of nature as the way things have to be or as prescribing the way things have to occur, but instead a descriptive of the regular processes that God has set in motion, or just the normal way God does things. Okay? So God, basically, either God chose to create the laws of nature as the regular way things operate, or the laws of nature are the regular way God operates in nature. But it doesn't mean that God would contradict himself in any way to choose to catch our attention by interrupting or superseding these laws. Okay? I don't know if I should get into the, if you really, and Spinoza is so tough to explain, but if you understand that from Spinoza, creation by God is necessary, it's not something that God chose to do, but had to do, when you really understand that, you'll see William Lane Craig's, it's an argument, you either get it or you don't, but you see where William Lane Craig says that if you have an eternal cause of a temporal creation, the eternal cause has to be personal. And the reason being is that he says, look, if there's a man eternally sitting, and then all of a sudden he stands up, there has to be a reason why he did that. Their personal choice comes into the picture. Otherwise, he would just be eternally seated the whole time. And
or if he had no choice but to stand up.
Well, it's basically if there's no choice, and if there's no decision, it would pretty much kind of entail there would be no change. But what I'm getting at is, if you understand where Spinoza, where his rational principles, he forces God into this box, and the creation that necessarily flows from him, then you can see why the reverse. It's good, you know, the reverse is also true, that if creation had a beginning, then it had to be a free choice. Because if creation wasn't God's choice, it was something that necessarily flows from him, it would have to necessarily flow from him through all eternity. But if God eternally existed, and then at some point in time decided to create, then all of a sudden there's got to be the choice there. There'd be no other way to explain it. So it's kind of like, but the problem is I don't use that argument from Craig, and it's only about a paragraph long in his apologetics text. I don't use it because it's very simple, but you either get it or you don't. And it seems to me like the people who get it are usually the people who understand where Spinoza is coming from. And the people who don't get it are the people who aren't familiar with Spinoza's argumentation. But whatever the case, the refutation of it is just that the laws of nature are not what Spinoza made them out to be. They're just kind of the regular way God allows things to occur. And that if God chooses to interrupt or supersede those laws, then he has, you know, in other words, God is not subject to the laws he created. Now, Spinoza would argue that God didn't create those laws. They flow from him just like the laws of logic. I think the burden of proof is on him. And, you know, if he wants to try to turn everything into a rational principle and equate the laws of reason with the laws of the physical universe, it seems that eventually you would just have to give up on the real existence of the physical world. But whatever the case, Hume, here's the way Hume really argued it. I don't have it in the notes here. But you, as an empiricist, you deal with the five senses, so you deal with the realm of probability. Okay. Remember I was talking about archaeologists who are dealing with the five senses, that their views are held tentatively. Okay. So when the people act like some archaeological dig has totally disproven the Bible, well, you know, where are these guys coming from? And so David Hume, as he wasn't totally consistent, you can't reject Jesus or the Bible and be totally consistent, but as a very consistent empiricist, he argued that the laws of nature are kind of the result of what people at all different times, all different places have reported. I mean, this is what almost universal experience tells us. And, you know, we see gravity pulling things down to the earth. We don't see things just, you know, floating away like the ascension. Dead bodies stay dead, you know. Now, keep in mind, this is David Hume argued that through empiricism, we cannot even prove that, you know, one guy punching another guy in the nose and the other guy's nose starts to bleed, all you can show is that where there is a punch in the nose, it is often followed by a bloody nose, but it doesn't mean that the punch caused the effect of a bloody nose, because cause and effect is not something we get from empiricism. See, when we say, okay, punching somebody in the nose often causes a bloody nose, we're assuming that when something almost always follows something else, then, you know, when B almost always follows A, then that means that A caused B, okay? And Hume will give you a few good examples for his argument against that. He says, well, the rooster crows, and then you see the sun rising. So, that means that the rooster causes the sun to rise? No. I believe where Hume is right here is that there is nothing in the five senses that tells us that A causes B. All the five senses tell us is that B usually follows A. Maybe even that B always follows A. Nothing in the senses, the world of the senses or sense perception, tells us that A causes B. But see, I'm not an empiricist. I'm not a strict empiricist. If I were a strict empiricist like Hume, I would agree with him. But there's more to human thinking than just the five senses. That's why I'm more of a rationalist than an empiricist. I believe God's created us with the rational equipment, maybe even what I would go so far as to call innate ideas, so that we have the innate idea of cause and effect. By the way, in a personal letter to John Stewart, David Hume said, look, he said, I'm not an idiot who denies the law of causality. All I'm saying is it's not self-evidently true, and we don't arrive at that law from the five senses. So basically what Hume was saying is, oh yeah, I believe in the law of causality, but I'm an empiricist who believes that, you know, you should only believe what you can prove through the five senses, and we can't prove the law of causality from the five senses. So basically what he was saying is, I've got my philosophy out here, but then I got to live as a human being over here. Okay? So, speaking as a philosopher, there's no basis for this rule, but hey, you know, I'm not going to reject the rule as a human being. Yeah, I rejected it in my philosophy. Okay? So, now Hume, you got to read him close in some places, because in his dialogues concerning natural religion, he basically concedes at the end that the evidence for the teleological argument, the argument from design for God's existence, is stronger than the evidence against it. So a lot of people use Hume to try to refute Paley's teleological argument. Two things should be said there. One is, had he known of Paley, he probably would have liked Paley's teleological argument. Number two, Paley wrote after Hume And when you look at the terminology that Paley uses, Paley is refuting Hume. Hume isn't refuting Paley. But whatever the case, Hume did seem to have that element that I'm an empiricist and here's what the five senses can produce, but there's some things that as a human being I believe that aren't proven by the five senses, and I won't, you know, it's not like he'll hold them dogmatic, all those views dogmatically and use it as part of his philosophy, but it's almost like his views as a philosopher were on one story and his views as a human being were on another story. And but whatever the case, based upon that, Hume could not, you know, Hume could say, well, just because the sun rises every morning, and he's using phenomenological language there, language of appearance, just because the sun rises every morning doesn't mean it's going to rise tomorrow. Just because we have sensed, human beings have through sense perception, seen the sun rising every day doesn't mean that the next time it's going to happen, because there we're assuming more than just sensation. See, but basically what he's saying is, you can't go, Hume is showing that induction in the end is somewhat of a fallacy. Yet Hume is actually, it's really ironic with his view on miracles, but the fact of the matter, what he's saying is that, yeah, just because my feet touch the ground every morning when I wake up doesn't mean that tomorrow morning my feet are going to touch the ground. I might get out of bed and float up into the air.
All natural, so, not miraculous.
So, what he's basically saying is you can't draw universal conclusions from particular. And in other words, if we examine 10,000 balls and found they were all white, that doesn't tell us anything about the 10,001st ball, if we have no other data to go with, okay? And so what he's saying is, just by saying, okay, I examined one thing, two things, now a million things, therefore everything, all the things beyond this 1 million things are just the way these other million are. It doesn't follow. And but see, what Hume as an empiricist doesn't have, this is what our whole century, you know, we want to be empiricists. We say truth only comes through the five senses, and we don't realize that if we hold to that premise, we don't have access to any universals. Okay. And other than the fact that, you know, the statement truth can only be found through the five senses is what? It's self-refuting, because you can't prove that statement true by the five senses, okay? But Hume's views led to Kant's distinction between reality as it appears to us versus reality as it is. We can only know the world of appearances, not the world of reality. And that eventually led to the verification principle, where truth can only be found through the five senses, which is self-refuting. Whatever the case, what Hume is saying is that, look, all we have are probabilities. If, in other words, if you throw out rationalism, you throw out any chance of arriving at certainties. So if we just deal with the five senses and induction, the study of the particulars, okay, then you can only draw probable conclusions. So Hume would not argue that miracles are impossible, because through empiricism, you can't prove anything is impossible. Okay? So what he would basically say is, we have to deal with probabilities. And when you look at what has been reported by humans over the centuries and what we experience now, the rational man, and by that the reasonable man, will only accept that which is the most probable. And since we have so much eyewitness testimony and so much sense experience that tells us that dead bodies stay dead, we'll never believe that a dead body can come back to life, because, and not because it's impossible, but because it's so improbable. You know, if billions of people have died and their bodies rotted, then yeah, it's always possible that the 1 billionth and first body isn't going to rot and is going to come back to life, but it's so improbable that the wise man will base his views on the highest, whatever has the highest degree of probability.
It's not impossible, it's plausible.
It's not impossible, but it's so improbable that basically only a person who lacks wisdom would believe in miracles. Now, one of the problems is he's talking about the uniform experience of mankind. Well, the only way that the uniform experience of mankind would tell us that only natural events have happened so far is if miracles were never reported. See what I'm saying? In other words, he's presupposing that we have no... Yeah, he's presupposing that miracles have never been empirically verified to try to say, well, you know, he's saying, look, miracles have never been witnessed, so we have no evidence for them, so the wise man isn't going to accept miracles. Even though anything's possible based just on empiricism. So, you know, this uniform experience of man is not so uniform. You know, and then he goes to say, you know, well, maybe we'll accept miracles if the eyewitnesses were this, if the eyewitnesses were that, if the eyewitnesses... And he lists all this criteria, and the fact of the matter is, you know, it's almost, you know, he's assuming that successful... educated people are automatically more reliable of witnesses than uneducated people. That's number one. Number two, he's assuming that the apostles in the early church were a bunch of idiots. I mean, because there's good evidence for them being very reliable. Okay?
He's biased right off the bat.
Yeah. So in the end, you know, but if you really accept his David Hume's argument... Well, what the thing is he's rejecting miracles because they're rare.
Well, never occurred.
Well, he can't really say never, because you can never say never with empiricism.
There was no.
He presupposes, you know, he's probably without realizing it, because but what I'm getting at is that he can't rule out anything with absolute certainty, so he's got to deal with just degrees of probability. So when everything's said and done, what he's saying is, because what he calls uniform human experience isn't really uniform, because certain people have claimed to have experienced miracles. So what he's calling uniform, the universal human experience is actually just the, you know, 99.9999%. So he's basically rejecting miracles because they're very, very unique, very, very rare.
But he still acknowledges it. It's rare.
He's acknowledging that certain people have reported that they have witnessed miracles. But he's saying, but the wise man is... How can you accept that an improbable event as that, when in our own experience we don't experience miracles? That's number one. And number two, the vast majority of people of history haven't claimed to have seen miracles. So he's saying these accounts are so rare that the wise man is always going to go with the side of probabilities and go with the side of the vast majority of what's reported. But the problem with that is that people have taken Napoleon, historians have taken Napoleon. So this is a very unique person, a very unique individual. And There's no other individual like him in human history. Based on Hume's premises, we should reject his existence. Because it's like, well, when I look at Napoleon David Hume, it's very improbable that anybody did these things. I know, in fact, so improbable, I know of nobody else in history who did these things. Well, you know, based on Hume's argumentation against miracles, it would also rule out the existence of David Hume.
Well, so it's except for the fact that Napoleon is universally known throughout Europe, he was in Africa, and even in North America.
No, it's basically, what I'm getting at here is his attack on miracles can be broken down to say that we reject miracles because they're so... We reject miracle claims because they're so rare.
Right, because it's the rarity that makes them you shouldn't believe it. Makes them
The rare or uniqueness. So we can't believe these stories about Napoleon. Same argument applied to Napoleon would say we can't believe these stories about Napoleon because they're so unique. We don't have anybody else that had experiences that even come close to the type that Napoleon had. Basically, what it amounts to is it's like saying because most bodies stay dead. Well, because all the bodies that I've examined, and all the bodies that a lot of the guys that I like reading that they've examined stay dead. Therefore, the wise man is going to conclude that everybody stayed dead. But what if you have eyewitnesses who die claiming this one body didn't stay dead? They're willing to die for that claim. Certainly, you've got to give it the time of day. And so, when everything's said and done, Hume is acting like the only way I'll accept miracles is if no. The only way I'll accept miracles is if they're very common. And that wouldn't empiricist, if Hume saw it, he would accept it. But basically, talking about miracles that are impossible for him to have seen 2,000 years ago, the only way I'll accept those miracles back then is if those things are going on today and I'm seeing them. In other words, the only way I'll accept miracles is if they commonly occur. Problem is, a miracle by definition...
If they commonly occur, or they're commonly believed that they have?
No, commonly occur. So in other words, I'll only believe that Jesus rose from the dead if lots of dead bodies are rising from the dead. But, you know, that's a fallacious argument. It's like I did an interview with Peter Sheldrup. Made a video...
I
did acknowledge that, but that's a separate thing than this other thing. In other words, it's not so much that I am the one seeing it occur. What he's saying is look, because with the laws of nature, what we're looking at are the normal, common way things occur, okay? And what he's saying is, I'm only going to settle on that which occurs with a high degree of probability. So he's saying, I'm only going to accept the normal occurrence of things, the common occurrence of things. Well, that's tantamount to saying, I'll only accept miracles if they occur on a regular basis, if they're common occurrences. The fact of the matter is, miracles lose all their strength.
There wouldn't be miracles.
Yeah, but miracles wouldn't be miracles without the backdrop of natural laws. Natural laws don't disprove miracles. Natural laws, the natural ways things occur, form the backdrop for us to even recognize a miracle when it occurs. So in other words, if there isn't a regular way that things occur, you know, if some dead bodies stayed dead and others just came to life on a regular basis, how could God even catch our attention by raising Jesus from the dead?
Okay.
Yeah. So the problem with Hume here, okay, when everything's said and done, the problem with Hume is that he's a strict empiricist. You know, I would argue that, if strict empiricism is true, you can't prove a miracle unless you yourself have seen it. But if strict empiricism is true, to be totally honest with you, there really isn't hardly anything you can prove. Hume even admits it. You can't even prove the sun's going to rise tomorrow if strict empiricism is true. So basically, God's built us with rational equipment that goes beyond the realm of the five senses, so we can know things beyond the realm of the five senses, and we have knowledge apart from sense experience. And when you start adding these other factors, all those problems that he presents disappear. But Hume just didn't argue miracles are impossible. He argued that a wise man will only accept probable events. A miracle, by definition, is a very improbable event. Therefore, a wise man will never accept them. But that's like saying the stories about Napoleon are hard to believe. The wise man will only accept what is easy to believe. Therefore, the wise man will reject the existence of Napoleon and say it's nothing but a bunch of legends. Okay? The fact of the matter is Napoleon is real, and even Hume would admit that. But to admit that Napoleon really existed and did those things would then leave the door open, based on Hume's argumentation, or a refutation of Hume's argumentation, would leave the door open for miracles. So when everything's said and done, it comes down to this. The laws of nature are descriptive. They describe the way things normally occur, generally occur. They don't prescribe the way things must occur. Okay? So, if God's the one who set up the laws of nature, then he's going to have no problem superseding them if he so chooses. So, basically, it just comes down to point C. If the God of the Bible exists, if a personal God exists, miracles are by definition possible. Doesn't mean any have occurred, but if a personal God exists, then it is possible that he has superseded the laws of nature that he set in motion, and miracles are possible. So therefore, each miracle claim, if you provide good evidence for the existence of a personal God, and we've done that already, then we have good reason to believe that miracles may have occurred. So what we have to do, since there's good evidence that God exists, that a personal God exists, each miracle claim should be investigated, not ruled out beforehand due to philosophical assumptions. When we argue that miracles are possible, we are not arguing that all miracles are actual. We're just saying it's possible for God to intervene and perform, and even for demons to intervene and perform supernatural works. In other words, we're arguing that not all causes do not have to be natural. There is, we now know that all of nature needs a cause. Well, that couldn't be a natural cause. It had to be a supernatural cause. So if there's a supernatural cause for all of nature, what makes us think that no causes within nature could be supernatural? And so basically, if the God of the Bible exists, then miracles automatically are possible. I think what we'll do, we'll just stop there. We're almost out of tape. But if anybody has any questions or comments, but you just keep in mind the distinction between Hume. Next week we'll talk about the resurrection was bodily, and then we'll defend the bodily resurrection of Christ. We'll be examining one miracle claim, the claim that Jesus Christ did in fact rise from the dead. But keep in mind the distinction between Hume and Spinoza. Hume was an empiricist, so he was saying miracles are so improbable that the wise man shouldn't believe in them. Spinoza, being a rationalist, said miracles are impossible by definition. Okay, and you know, rationalists are deducing from universal principles a conclusion that follows with rational certainty. And empiricists, he's through induction, he's saying, well, this is probably going to be the outcome, but we can't know for sure because we're empiricists. We can't know anything for sure. Of course, how could you know that statement for sure? I mean, empiricism is bankrupt from the beginning. Rationalism, I mean, other than the laws of mathematics and the laws of logic, what could you really know with certainty if you acknowledge the existence of the physical realm? If you don't acknowledge the existence of the physical realm, I don't have much time for you. I mean, because I'm living in that world, so. What's that?
Sounded like he was just biased there.
What it amounted to is just, you know, you just had this big all or nothing. You just had this big all or nothing mentality that, you know, either we could find all truth through reason or we could find all truth through the senses. And you just had different guys on different sides of the issue. And I think when everything's said and done, you've got to allow a certain place for both. If you don't, you're just going to be running into dead-end streets left and right. So, but, you know, Aquinas was an empiricist, but not a strict empiricist. And Augustine was a rationalist, but not an extreme rationalist. And so I think you've got much more balance in the Christian thinkers than you have in the non-Christian thinkers.
Mm-hmm. The person I really hear, probable,